Vaishnavanscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Taitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakham Vitamscha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This morning I'm going to speak on some anarthas, or unwanted attitudes, which are obstacles in devotional advancement, some specific anarthas which I have not particularly observed here at ISKCON Vela, but by hearing about which we can, even though it may not affect you personally directly at the present time, all the anarthas, they all spring from the tendency to not want to serve Krishna, to promote oneself, to pursue a misconceived sense of self-interest, which manifests as the tendency to exploit others, the tendency to try to cheat others, and this can enter into devotional service also. So, the first one I'm going to speak about is something that was brought to my attention by my godbrother, our godbrother, Tejas Prabhu, who probably most of you don't know. Srila Prabhupada gave him that name. It's very fitting to his personality because he's a very powerful, intense kind of person, although in an unusual way. It's not manifest a lot of the time. He's also a very, generally very quiet and gentlemanly, but he has a very intense approach to everything he does. So he brought this to my attention that, you know, when I first heard it, I was surprised, and you'll probably be surprised also if you haven't heard this before, that collecting funds for cow protection actually encourages cow slaughter. So, it's surprising. I'll explain it as he explained it to me. That cow slaughter, this when Hindu organizations in India target Muslims for killing cows and say that the slaughterhouses should be closed, a common response, so I am told, from Muslims is that, well, it's your people who are selling the cows to us. They're also implicit. Most of the cows are owned by Hindus. Most of the population is Hindu. Still, don't know how long that will still be true in India. So it's not surprising that most of the cows are owned by Hindus. And they sell them to Muslims. Why do they do that? If it used to, I mean, still is, and it used to be much more, an implicit principle of that difficult to define phenomenon known as Hinduism, that cows should never be killed. So why is it that, and Hindus in general have a sentiment for cows, so why do they sell their cows to people who they don't ask questions, but they must know that they're being sold, they're going to be slaughtered? Why do they do that? The answer is, any brilliant ideas from any of you? It's an easy thing to understand. Why do they do that? Because they want the money! Money, 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 money. The number one, who's the number one God in India? Is it Krishna or Ganesh or Sai Baba or Allah? It's money. Everywhere. And it may not even be so much rank greed. I'll say that again. It may not be so much rank greed, because when someone coughs, the sound tends to get covered by that sound. But it's just what is considered an economic necessity, that everything in the world nowadays runs on the principle of money. And if you keep a cow, and as long as it's giving milk, you're getting money, but then when it stops giving milk, you don't get money, and you still have to feed it. So people can't afford it. So they sell it. And therefore, the idea is there that we'll have goshalas, homes for cows, in which old cows which would otherwise be sold for slaughter, we'll take them and feed them and support them. But Tejas Prabhu explained that actually cows in traditional culture are a sign of opulence. Who has got more cows is more wealthy. Because cows produce milk, and they produce stool and urine, which is also valuable. And they produce bulls, which are also valuable, not in the modern age, because we have the mechanical bull called the Massey Ferguson or whatever, tractor. Bulls are also not only tractors, but not only for plowing, but for all kinds of conveyance of goods. Bulls are required in human society for bringing something, just like bags of grains from one place to another. Then bulls are required in traditional society. So cows are valuable. Gavayo dhanavan, dhanyavan, dhanavan. Srila Prabhupada used to quote, who's got cows and grains, they are wealthy. And other things, gold, silver, diamonds, other jewels, they're secondary, because silk, yeah, these are considered signs of opulence. But these are secondary because in times of difficulty, then food is the most required item. And you can't eat gold and diamonds. So if we advertise that we're collecting money to support cows, it gives the idea that cows are an economic liability. And therefore, on the whole, people will be less inclined to keep cows. And it perpetuates the idea that cows are an economic liability that we have to collect money for. They're a burden. Now, there may be some cases where collection for cows is justifiable. Just like if you have this goshala for old cows that would otherwise be slaughtered, then, all right. Although you can only, keeping a goshala for old cows that would also be otherwise be slaughtered, that also adds indirectly to the problem. Because people who have taken service from cows, they should continue to protect them and not reject them when they become old. Just like your old mother, when she's old and she's been serving you all her life, you don't sell her to be sold. Not yet. You never know. You know, you have all these you have overpopulation and all these old people who are useless, and who's going to know the difference if we make them into mincemeat? The day is coming. May come. So it's a noble idea, but the real thing is to educate people. That's a much bigger job, to educate people about the need for cows. That it's not proper to kill. It's nowadays, if we talk of cow protection, then it becomes a Hindu-Muslim issue. It becomes a sectarian issue. But we should educate everyone that the cow is valuable. Even in old age, they give the stool and urine, which that's also very valuable. Who is that? Recently, someone told me that. Oh yeah, Gokul Chandra told me that in Bangalore, some of his friends, they had some in their house. They have one floor which they rent out. So some Iranian students were living there. So they said to them that you can take the rooms on rent on the condition that you don't cook beef. And they were upset. They said, "We don't cook beef. Only low-class people cook beef. In our country, the high-class people, they'll never eat cows." So that's going on since maybe pre-Muslim times, when they had their Zoroastrian culture, which is it's a kind of Hindu culture. And I believe, is it in Pakistan that it's illegal to kill cows only on, you have to get permission or something to do that? Because, which country is that? One Muslim country, so, because they're considered a national asset, cows and bulls, for agriculture. So it's not impossible to convince if we try. And if we say, if we try to make a riot every time a cow is killed by Muslims, then there's no end. It'll just perpetuate more violence and more violence and more violence. Some show of force can be effective. But in the long term, we're going to have to convince, which means actually a whole change in the economy from the oil-powered economy, which is going to happen anyway because the oil is going to run out. You know, the economies are going to collapse. Right now, America's on the precipice. Unless they make some severe economic reforms, then the whole economy is going to go down very quickly. And then most likely people will go back to the land, as is happening in Greece, where their economy is already collapsed. And it's likely to happen to one country after another in the Western world, because they're all living artificially on borrowed money. So in America, there's plenty of land, so people can just go to the land. And of course, it's not so easy because it's all owned by big corporations, whereas in Greece, still there's small farms are there. In Russia, there's plenty of land, but the only problem is the growing season's only about 5 months. Very good land, a lot of. Where you're from, Tatarstan, the land is so good. You practically don't have to do any farming, just things grow by itself. But it is first-class land there. But again, the problem is most of the year it's the climate is too cold to grow anything. 4 months, 4 months growing season. Of course, you can always grow indoors in what used to be called greenhouses or glass houses, but now Now it's mostly done with plastic, so that's possible also. Then you can grow throughout the year. So, yeah, that's one point that about collection for cows. The idea is not bad, but the spirit behind it is not bad, but the actual effect might be opposite. It's understandable if there's a temple in a city, which we want to keep cows for having milk for the deities, and as a kind of, what should we say, vaibhav for the temple, because Krishna likes to have cows. We always call that an opulence or for the temple. So that's understandable, but you don't have very big goshalas in the city. But in general, part of our mission as aspiring devotees of Krishna and followers of Srila Prabhupada is to demonstrate how simple living, cow protection, varnashram, is God-centered life, is a much better way of life for everyone. Not even speaking spiritually, but even materially, people can live very nicely like this. Just like now, we're here, it's very peaceful. We just heard one cow calling in the distance. Whereas in the city, people are full of tension and always too busy, running here and there all the time. So that's one point. Another point, which is somewhat connected, is that we should avoid telling lies or stretching the truth, as sometimes it's called. It's a euphemistic way of saying telling lies, stretching the truth. Or sometimes another way of telling lies is called being economical with the truth. It means you just don't tell it. You say something else instead. So, it's not impossible within the scope of Krishna consciousness. Sometimes we have to do it. As I've several times given the example, if I go to a country where I know that the government is not very favorable to Krishna consciousness, then I'll go looking like dressed like a tourist. And if they ask me what I'm doing, I'll say, well, just visiting, just come for a few days, just to have a look and this and that. So it's a lie, frankly. I mean, it's not totally untrue. You could say it's being economical with the truth. I mean, I will be I'll be looking around when I'm there, but that's not the main reason for coming. The main reason is to preach Krishna consciousness. So sometimes we have to say that. So that's allowable within the scope of our mandate. Srila Prabhupada once related in a letter, I believe, that he had heard some of his godbrothers, they would collect, saying that our spiritual master lives in the forest and only eats tulsi leaves, and which is not true. Maybe in his gopi form, but no, the gopis, they don't only eat tulsi leaves. They eat milk products and grains and so many things. So, it's a lie. But it was effective in collecting, it helped to collect funds, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur didn't disapprove of that. So, theoretically, we can do anything or say anything in Krishna's service. But most people won't understand that. And if they find out that we're telling lies, just like if we say at our center we have 200 lepers, please give a donation, and they come and find, oh, where are all the lepers? Well, they all died, or they all went on a holiday, but they come 3-4 times, and never any lepers there, and they come to find out that it's just a bluff, and they won't be pleased. They'll think, why are these people bluffing like this. And so that will work against us in the long term. So it's better to be straightforward and just say what we're doing. That we can sometimes stress more the activities that will appeal to people. Just like we can say, we have a school, a very good school, of course, our school. In our schools, if we're actually following Srila Prabhupada, we teach Krishna consciousness, so people may not be very pleased for that. They may or may not, it depends. But the general point is that if we tell lies, it may be fruitful in the short term, but in the long term, people are going to be dissatisfied, and they will turn against us. Similarly, illegal activities, again, especially in a country like India, in which corruption is part of the modern culture here. Of course, corruption is not only in India, but it's very much part of life here. You can't get any government permission to do anything without offering a little favor to the person who has to sign the paper for you, or even the person who has to take the paper to the person who has to sign it. You have to. So it's not really a favor. It's just part of the economy. That's all. That the businessmen they calculate, and it's all part of the way of life. So it may not be possible in this country, or in any country, to always follow the law precisely. But as far as possible, we should do. Another thing which is similar to this is we should be very careful of these get-rich-quick kind of schemes. Just like you could... or making money very easy. Yesterday, one businessman who came to visit, he showed me a video clip. He showed it to you also? Yeah. Of something in Hindi, I presumably it appeared on TV, saying that ISKCON is making lots of money and is doing money laundering and sending money to America and this and that. So I said to him, well, it's possible. ISKCON's a big society, and some the wrong kind of people can join it. But in general, our mission is spiritual. And I asked him that, well, how do you feel coming here? Do you feel like it's a bazaar or it's a spiritual atmosphere? And he said, yes, it's like a mandir. But we do hear stories of gurus who, within general Hinduism, who suddenly become prominent, and all of a sudden they're being advertised here and there. And we hear unofficially that they're getting lots of black money and this kind of thing. This money laundering, this kind of thing. Like someone gives a bribe or whatever, they give a few crores to some spiritual organization, and they can somehow get it back to them and make the money, changing black money to white, this kind of thing. So they're accusing ISKCON of that. And I do know, I've been told of one case in Australia where a devotee was doing that, and it was found out by the government. And it would have been a very big thing, but he was smart enough to do it through a loophole in the law. So it wasn't, technically, it wasn't illegal. So they changed, on finding this out, they changed the law in Australia. That's what I was told. Because ISKCON does deal in large amounts of money, if you take the whole organization put together. And... where there's money, there's Kali. That's Parikshit Maharaj gave Kali Maharaj place to stay. Where can you stay? Where there's gold. Oops. He's in your shop. So you have to be very careful. Gold in general, that means money. So we have to be careful of that and not succumb to that temptation. When we get money, then we tend to feel, now I'm something very special. So we should be very careful. Sadhus, or people who have renounced this world, they're supposed to be free from the temptations of Kanaka Kamini, gold and women. So as we're preaching organization, we deal in these things. We not only do accept money, but we canvass people to give it. And women, yeah, we have to preach. So women are 50% of the population. The brahmacharis and sannyasis may not mix very intimately with them, but you can't avoid them or pretend that they don't exist if we're going to have an effective preaching movement. So, but we have to be very careful and always remain aloof. It's a good idea there's a suggestion that in any center of ISKCON, it doesn't have to be like this, but if there's a renunciant as the head of the local center or the institution, sannyasi, brahmachari, senior brahmachari, then people can look up to that person as a spiritual head or spiritual guide, because it's a spiritual institution. They generally tend to look up to renunciants as spiritual leaders, although grihasthas can also be fully spiritual. But in the eyes of most people, if people have wife, children, home, that is somewhat, they tend to see them as less spiritual. And actually they do have to spend considerable part of their time involved in domestic and social matters. So it's a good idea. It's a good idea if the leader is a renunciant, but if he can delegate the management to grihasthas, that's also as far as possible. I mean, there's no ideal situation, but that's also that will be appreciated. We find that in many respected spiritual or pseudo-spiritual or whatever organizations in India, that the head of the mat will be the sannyasi, and the management is done to a large extent by grihasthas. Now, another point, in a different category to the ones which I've been speaking about. Appointing oneself as a shiksha guru. Someone may be preaching to others, bringing them to Krishna consciousness, but then he can't claim, now I am your shiksha guru. He may be looked up to by others like that, but you can't claim that, and now you have to do what I say. I mean, even Diksha gurus, they soon find out, I know myself, that you can't expect from disciples like unswerving obedience to everything you say, because people have their limitations. They're trying to be devotees. It doesn't mean they're perfect devotees. So, although from the disciple's point of view, he should always do what the guru says, but the guru has to be flexible enough to understand that people are at different levels and Most devotees are not very surrendered, and even those who are more surrendered, to be a disciple doesn't mean to be a total slave. Maybe in the Gurukul, the boys are trained like that. Dasavan acharan nijo, that's described in Bhagavatam. Dasavan, sometimes the word das is translated as slave. There's no real concept of slavery in Vedic culture, but the word das, servant, in the secular sense, although again in traditional, in Varnashram culture, there's no major division between secular and religious as there is in the Western way of thought. But the word for slave is in Hindi, it's like many words, like divorce. There's no word as such. It's an Urdu word. It's imported from Arabian and other languages like that. So to claim oneself to be a Shiksha Guru and then to lord it over and dominate others, this is not very proper. It's natural that devotees who are being guided by others tend to look up to those devotees who are guiding them with affection, to look up to them just like Shiksha Gurus, but to demand that now I preach to you, now I'm your Shiksha Guru and you have to do what I say. This is not correct. So, just that point. These points I wanted to make, as I said at the beginning of the class, that these various anarthas, which I've not observed here in particular, I've observed in different places. It's the Shiksha Guru thing you find from time in different parts of the world, especially in places where people do tend to be somewhat submissive by their culture. In Russia, because the history of Russia is to be ruled harshly extremely harshly, more so than probably any other country, certainly any other major country in the world. So people are used to doing what they're told. Otherwise, they'll be very severely punished. So of course, it's not like that now in Russia, but that's the culture. So people tend to be submissive to leaders. In India also, because of that religious culture of submitting to gurus, it's very different if you go to America especially, where people have the idea, we're all free and we'll do what I like and I don't do what anyone says, although they all do. If you join a company and they say, well, I don't do what anyone says, then you don't have a job. But there's this idea that you're free, the land of the free. But in India, people, because of that culture, people expect to be to accept authority of seniors, elder people, spiritually advanced people. So it's possible to exploit people by taking advantage of that culture. Or even if one has a good intent to guide them and this and that, still you can't just force people to be your, or just tell them, now I am your Shiksha Guru. It has to come from their side. And in many cases, it doesn't need to be spoken either. It's just like there are many devotees who I'm guiding, or they look to me for advice, who they're not officially initiated by me, but they may come to me from time to time. They may be initiated by someone else and ask questions. But I don't say that, well, now I'm your Shiksha Guru and you have to do everything I say. It's a natural relationship like that. So, Hare Krishna, any question about this? About these points? Mm. in modern culture now in India are also getting all these bad ideas. And I think Bangalore is the capital of that. Wherever there's the IT industry, the IT professionals, they tend to be, have a very insolent kind of attitude toward others. And in Bangalore also, you see people, they don't care for their parents. I was in a hospital once getting a checkup, and the doctor I was speaking to, he said, oh, these people, they left their mother. She's very sick. And the two brothers came and said, you look after her. We're going away. Whatever it costs, we'll pay, but you just look after her. That's all. They didn't care to, because they're busy. They're businessmen. They can't stay to wait for them. Even the doctor, he was saying, you know, people nowadays, they're all like that. They don't care for their elderly parents. And you'll find also, it's coming up in India, these vriddhashrams, old age homes, because people, they don't want to look after their parents. Many young girls, they'll marry. They say, I'll marry you on one condition. We won't live with your parents. Which is the normal thing, that you live, the girl moves in with the boy's parents when they're married, and then as the parents get older, then they're looked after, but they don't want to do that. So, yeah, everything bad is coming. So we have to, what can we do? We have to try to try to counter that. There's a lot of publicity all over the world now about a gang rape in Delhi in which a girl died. And it's bad, there's no doubt about it, but are there no rapes in other countries? They all, the world press always wants to show that India is very bad and their culture is very bad. People overseas, they have the idea that most women in India, they're burned to death by their family members, and there's this impression. Really, they have a very, there's like a worldwide conspiracy against it. I think because they realize that the culture is, well, one reason is India is becoming more and more important in the world in terms of economic and political importance, and it does have a culture very different to that of the West. And I think the West is threatened by that, especially America was founded on the basis of Christianity and or what they call Christianity. But actually, Christianity has been much subverted in the West because literally millions of people do yoga, they believe in reincarnation. Their attitudes are more like Hindu attitudes than Christian. Just like this idea, you know, let all, just tolerate everyone, respect everyone. That's not a typical traditional Western attitude. The Western attitude is, we're Christians, and this is it, and to hell with you. That's robustly Christian. We have to go out and colonize the world because they're all heathens. We have to give them the message of Christ. But modern America, even many Christians are not like that. So they feel threatened, and they want to portray everything in India bad. And there are many things in India that are bad, no doubt. But it's not that the West is without social problems, or that it's that there's this idea coming from the West that we are enlightened. Still, it's going on since the colonial times of the 19th century. We are enlightened, and we have to teach other people how to live. You see, they have to have democracy. In India, people are saying democracy, it's something wonderful. But Prabhupada, he didn't think so. I thought he called it demon crazy. And the idea, you know, everyone should be equal, which is not possible. All the idea that we're much better, we're We're in Afghanistan. The American troops are in Afghanistan because we have to give them democracy and equal rights and all. That's all. They're there because geopolitical center of the oil world. They want to bring oil from Kazakhstan through Afghanistan and out to eventually to America. But there's this idea that we have to give them the proper values, and very extremely arrogant. If there are any problems in India or other countries, they think, well, it's because their culture is so bad and they're so ignorant. If there's problems, similar problems in their own country, they think, well, it's just an aberration. It means something unusual. Just like there are riots in America from time to time. There are school shootings in which they kill so many. We don't say that, well, you know, it's because, you know, it's America. They're so primitive and backward. They don't say like that. Oh, something. How could it happen in our civilized America? But if such a thing happened in India, say, oh, India, you know, what do you expect? You know, they're Indian. They must be backward. That's their whole. So, all right, Hare Krishna. Anything? Question, comment, protest? Yeah. Indian leaders are talking about democracy, and what is it? We want a king? Everyone is a king. Well, that's not possible. That's like saying everyone is a king in democracy. It's like saying everyone is supreme. Then no one's supreme. We say on the basis of Shastra that Krishna is supreme. But if you say Krishna is supreme and Shiva is supreme and Durga is supreme and Chandra is supreme and Indra is supreme and Sai Baba is supreme and my mother-in-law is supreme, then there's no meaning to it. Supreme means above everyone else. So if you say everyone's a king, it's meaningless. It's not that everyone becomes a king. Everyone becomes without a specific role in so-called democracy. No one knows what they're supposed to be doing. Still, to some extent, there's traditional societies going on. We see in towns like Vellore, there still traditional Vaishyas, like yourself. You're from a traditional Vaishya family. And yesterday, those different people came. I mean, their whole bhav is Vaishya, isn't it? They're traditional families who they do business, and they're pious, and they give donations, and this and that. They all over India, you'll find Vaishyas. It's a different mood to Brahmanas or Shudras. They're very interested in making money, very good at making money, generally quite pious also, like that. And they like sense enjoyment, but not in a gross way. They like to have nice houses. Then their wives will have lots of gold and jewelry and like that. But in a civilized kind of way, not a gross way. Like that. So still you'll find people like that. You still find plenty of people who are Shudra by nature, and they know it, and they're quite happy. They'll come to the temple, they'll do physical work and all this kind of thing. They're not trying to say now we're Brahmanas and all this. So still some remnants of the old system are there. Some good facets of that. Hare Krishna. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada.